Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP. Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 130 of Registry Matters. Larry, it is yet another Saturday night, and we've made it for a whole other week.
We did. I don't know how, but we've managed.
We did. It's pretty amazing. Anything exciting going on this week?
We are headed towards a partial additional reopening coming Monday. So the governor made an announcement a couple of days back. That was exciting for the businesses that are going to be able to open at some level.
And have you been effectively shut down still since then?
Well, it depends on what you mean by shut down. The law offices that do regular law work are listed in the exempt category. They've been able to operate all along. The nonprofits, on the other hand, it's clear that most nonprofits that weren't provided essential health-related services were closed down. So the Liberty and Justice Coalition and NARSL effectively shut down, except for volunteer work that's being done. But we're not having our part-time staffer coming into the office, because I read the order to include my interpretation was that we were not essential.
I gotcha. How about like restaurants and so forth? Because Georgia, has it been a month? It's at least been 3 weeks since they started opening things back up.
We have been on takeout, drive-through and takeout service only. Monday, they're going to be able to open at 50% of rated capacity with all the PPE that you can find, which is hard to find, but with paper menus and with people distancing and the hope is there won't be a spike. We've actually had a really good trend, with exception of McKinley and San Juan County, which encompasses a lot of reservation land, and they're really struggling on Navajo land. But we've actually had a pretty good stabilization and actually a decline in new cases in most of our other counties.
So speaking of restaurants and paper menus, you've heard of a restaurant change called Waffle House?
I think so. They're pretty much nationwide. I've heard of them. Yes.
They're the only place that I've been to that they have a QR code, and I'm hoping you know what a QR code is.
And I do.
Where it's just like a whole bunch of little boxes inside of a square. Their menus are available on a QR code, so you can just use your phone to look at the menu, which I find to be very cool, and I haven't seen any of the places do it.
Well, I haven't gone to a Waffle House in, I think, since we were in Atlanta at the conference, but that's not one of my normal dining establishments, but I'll keep that in mind.
Yep, there you go. I want to announce that we had like a whole cornucopia of a cacophony, I guess maybe a better word, of patrons this week. And I blanked on announcing one from the week before was Ashley. But so we got Ashley, Don, Hal, and a very generous contribution from Teresa. And then also Mr. Anonymous tripled his monthly contribution.
So that puts him at $1,500 a month, right?
Pretty close to it, yes. He was doing gross before, and now he's triple gross.
Oh, well, no, it's not quite that, but tripling is it's all relative to what you're giving. But I think that regardless of the base amount, it's an expression of appreciation and gratitude. And so if you triple your contribution, generally that would be an affirmation that you value it. I wouldn't pay triple what I'm paying for the Albuquerque Journal. So I struggle to pay what I pay for it, much less tripling it.
Yes, and I can't thank everybody enough. That definitely gets us closer to our patron goal of 100 people, gets us much closer. And I can't thank you all from the bottom of my heart enough for contributing to this little project that we do every week.
And we're going to be at 100 by the end of August.
How about, let's go into a question that we received. It's in relation to our content from last week. Will in Tennessee, he says, William in Tennessee says, how many times will humans forced to register have to be slaughtered by vigilantes before the courts get honest about the inhumane, cruel, and unusual punishment the registry exposes individuals listed thereunto? Again, I bring up Judge Mache's ruling that is still languishing in the Tenth Circuit. Judge Mache made such a true statement when he said the sex offender registry tells the public, these people are dangerous. How is the public supposed to react to that? The cruel and unusual punishment of the registry comes not from the government, but from the public at large. This act of vigilante murder proves Judge Mache exactly right.
What I can't wrap my mind around is how the registry can be considered so punitive that it outstrips its stated purpose when applied retroactively in violation of the ex post facto prohibition, and thus be unconstitutional, but not be considered in the same light when applied prospectively. It's a neat question, Larry.
I really like the question, and it gives us a chance to do a deeper dive. I'm sure this is inspired by the recent decision in Tennessee that we talked about last week. And the answer is kind of convoluted. When you bring challenges, your intent is to win, and your focus is on the client that you're representing, the client or the group of clients. And those clients have to have standing to make the challenges, to assert the challenges that they're asserting. If your crime predates the registry, you would be limited to making that challenge, because if they passed a new law that for people that were convicted after the registry, that's not your issue. Your issue is that the registry is unconstitutional as applied to you. When you look at what the plaintiffs were challenging, what was at issue before the court, that was the issue. They chose the ex post facto clause because they thought that they could win. The cruel and unusual punishment clause is a much more difficult one to win under, because regular listeners have been around for a while, I've said, and we've played clips of late Justice Scalia talking about cruel and unusual. It's a very high standard, because it looks at backwards at what punishments were in play at the time as far as the conservative originalist interpretation. And executing people was not viewed cruel and unusual. So if putting someone to death by very painful means, which we've done throughout the history of the Republic, it's hard to imagine that when you force someone to sign their name on a list and have their picture made available on a medium that nobody could have ever even fathomed back in the colonial times, but that would be cruel and unusual if taking their very life away isn't. Well, that's where the problem lies. It may be cruel and unusual punishment if we have a different group of interpreters on the Supreme Court, and the person with the requisite standing asserts that, and they build up an evidentiary record at trial. It may be that we can prove that the mere registering and putting all the information, which is not public, does in fact inflict cruel and unusual punishment. Most of the challenges have not that has not been raised as the issue. So the courts don't operate as roving tribunals looking for things that you could have asserted. They look at what you did assert. And therefore, if we want to make that claim, we have to start building cases saying that the registry is cruel and unusual punishment. We need to pony up a bunch of money to build the evidentiary record that it's going to take to put on the experts to show how cruel and punishment it is. Anecdotal evidence is not enough. And everybody struggles with that. Yes, we know it intuitively. We know that there's going to be harm that flows to registrants. But we don't know, we can't prove conclusively that it flowed as a result of the registry, that they didn't go down to the old-fashioned criminal records repository and find out that you had this criminal record, and they didn't look you up through many of the massive publicly. I think you did a background check on me one time, and you told me who my relatives were and stuff, but just in the click of a mouse or two, and my most recent addresses, right? You remember that?
I do.
Yeah. Well, so we don't know that. We have to prove that if we're gonna say the registry constitutes cruel and unusual punishment. Remember, it's presumed constitutional until we prove that it isn't. And the presumption weighs heavily in favor of the lawmakers would never pass an unconstitutional law.
But we do.
Great question.
We do know that they don't.
Well, we know that they pass unconstitutional laws, but sometimes you don't know that they're unconstitutional. To give people the benefit of the doubt, the people that are advising them, the people that have the pretty uniforms and the people who have the clean-cut cropped hair, the people who hold offices called state attorney general, the head of the sheriff's association, all these different people that you look to for advice, when they're telling you it's not unconstitutional, and your day job is something other than being a constitutional lawyer, which most citizen legislators, that their day job is not being a constitutional lawyer. Their day job may be any number that runs the gamut of what society represents society. They don't know all this stuff. What are they supposed to do?
True that. And then I guess you could, if we're going to hold the standards from when things were signed, whatever, 240 years ago, And like you said, if cruel and unusual punishment was like, you can't make punishment worser, then whatever was considered acceptable punishment, then you would have to think that having your name listed on a website, well, that's not having poo thrown at you and rubbed in open wounds while they execute you. Like, that would make punishment worser. So how is just having your name on a website so bad? And yes, I'm saying all that tongue in cheek, don't take this out of context, all that. But I get the point. But if we do have an evolving set of standards, then having this little public scarlet letter would totally be punishment.
The second part component of Will's question is that the cruel and unusual punishment, senility here. The ex post facto clause, is unequivocal that it intends to prohibit you from having punishment imposed upon you that you wouldn't have known about at the time, or punishment increased from the time that post the when you commit the event, you need to be on notice. The ex post facto clause does not prevent you from imposing prospective punishment that's very harsh. Punishment is left in the eye, left to the discretion of the people that we elect to represent us. So the fact that we impose these registration requirements that none of us support on anybody, if it's done prospectively, at least you had notice prior to it happening, as opposed to the sheriff knocking at your door and saying, by the way, you committed this crime at 86, we've tracked you down, you have to register now for the rest of your life.
It is significantly harder to then go visit your local courthouse to find any sort of records on the person. You may, I think, maybe you may even have to pay a fee to do it. Do you think, if you're trying to look up someone's criminal background at the courthouse?
Well, you run into some fees, but with digitization, it's those fees are a lot less common now. In the old days, you would go down and you would actually have them pull old paper files, and depending on how old or the age of the case, they may have to keep you waiting for days while they pull that out of some archival storage if it right. hadn't been destroyed.
Yeah.
And nowadays it's all been digitized. They've been scanning stuff for years and years and years of old files. And so the cost is not really such a barrier anymore. There's these private businesses that have just been scarfing up records left and right.
Certainly.
And making them available. I mean, that's capitalism at its finest. I don't know how anybody in our listening audience, which is capitalism is the greatest system ever devised, why would we have any opposition to people scarfing up records and being an entrepreneur and figuring out how to make money from having those records?
Absolutely. All right.
that also is tongue in cheek, because we are going to have a conversation at some point in this country about what records should become invisible and when. Otherwise, we're going to have a society of lepers.
Yeah, we definitely have a society of lepers. Well, I guess we should start moving on to some articles.
I think that's a good thing. So the next article is about the Louisville police chief, Steve Conrad, announces his retirement.
Now, why would a police chief go off and retire?
Well, I suspect it had to do with the public outcry over Breonna, the Taylor shooting that we talked about last week with the no-knock warrant. And I guess one of the officers got shot in the leg, and one of the counselors said that the person who did the shooting was a hero, which that's one way of looking at it. If you think your house is being raided by criminals and you shoot at one of the attackers, that's a justifiable way to look at it.
My understanding is that the male, boyfriend, husband, forgive me on that, there was a male in the house with the woman, and he called 911. There's a 911 call of, hey, look, there are people breaking into my house.
That's what I say. That's the danger of doing stuff in the middle of the night. You're not expecting it. That's why we're so hot to trot at Narsal with Cobb County going out in Georgia, Cobb County right. going out knocking on doors late at night, because it's a dangerous situation.
Larry, maybe we should put in the correspondence with them about, hey, did you see this happening in Kentucky? Be careful. This may happen to you.
Well, they would probably get us for terroristic threats if we did that.
We did imply
that strongly in the letter that going to people's houses at late at night is a risky proposition. That's the one time when you're expecting to have a little bit of privacy. You're doing various things, including sleep and things you might do before you sleep.
Yes, and, there are other things that people do in bedrooms.
And you're not expecting a loud pounding at the door, nor are you expecting for someone to start cracking their way through your property without announcing themselves. You're just not expecting that. And a rational reaction is to fire away.
Yes. And we do have Second Amendment privileges, rights to own weapons. And like the police would have to expect this coming through the door. But to you know, not to really get on their defensive side so much, but you know, the police would be justified in firing back, I suppose.
Well, I think it'd be a natural reaction, but then the question is, did the police create the situation to start with by not announcing themselves and by getting a no-knock warrant and by serving it in the middle of the night? What culpability does the police have for this?
Certainly. And because of that, so now she is dead, and I can't imagine, like, you're just doing your whatever you're doing, like whether you're just napping, sleeping, and there's the pounding, and next, you know, like, hey, I'll see you tomorrow at work. And hey, overnight, your coworker got shot 8 times, I think this was, by the police.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
This is really tragic. It really infuriates me. But so the sheriff has stepped down.
The police chief of the city, yeah, has stepped down. And so now they're going to do a nationwide search to find a replacement.
Yeah, and the, I guess like the deputy is going to serve as the interim chief. All right, well, that's great news. Hopefully somebody doesn't suppose, hopefully that police, that the interim police chief will try to have some like sensitivity training to try and keep them from doing this. Like, what is the course of action that the next police chief comes in and does?
The chief won't be able to do it. I mean, the chief could do it. The chief possesses the power to do it, but it's one of those things like what you can do versus what you will do. The police chief, in order to have loyalty and the rank and file would turn their back if the police chief were to decry on his own initiative or her own initiative. It happens to be a woman chief. They would undermine the chief. So the chief has to have political cover to do anything. It really rests with us, the people, and we're going to get into it more when we get into the Minnesota case situation, but. When are we going to take control of our police? That's what we're going to delve into later in the main event.
Sure. Then we have a couple articles that I'm not really sure I remember where they came from, but the website is called Frank Report, and there are two articles about our people, PFRs. The first one is interviews with several people, including Sandy of Narsal and Vicky of War and so forth, about just the tragedy and the misconception of what the registry is, who's on it, and what it means, and the impact that it has. And I didn't necessarily want to go into it in a whole great level of detail, but I really just wanted to point out to it that was the first article. And the second article was some interviews with some of our people that are PFRs.
Yeah, I did a skim read of that, and I didn't put it in here, so it must have fallen in from the heavens.
It could have, but I know that I put it in. I just don't remember where I picked it up. I could have picked it up off of Reddit, maybe, but I don't recall. But, you know, I just always like to point out these articles when they end up out there in the on the interwebs, the intertubes, to you know, this is someone that I don't believe has a whole lot of relationship with us, and he is listed, like his own self-bio says that he is some kind of investigative journalist, independent, just doing his own thing. Frank Parlato is the individual's name. Frank Report.
Well, on the interviews of the 5 registered offenders, I'm glad that the people are willing to be interviewed. What strikes me always is that there seems to be a tone of "I don't deserve this," and of course, no one deserves it in my view. But they point out the relative benign nature of their offenses, and not all 5 of them did that. But they point out, well, I was 21 and she was 15. If she'd been 2 weeks older, it'd been okay. Well, yes, it would have been.
Right.
But it wasn't. And the person who says that is pronouncing the registry and this humiliation okay if the right person is subjected to it, which I don't believe anyone should be subjected to this, particularly after they've paid their debt to society. Now, some of these are still on supervision and they're paying their debt. But when you have finished paying your debt, there can be no justification for imposing any disability restraint upon you, any accountability upon you, any tracking upon you. That is not justifiable. We are supposed to be restored. When you pay your debt, you're done. And I don't want this imposed on anyone, and particularly if they paid their debt.
Certainly. It is pretty brutal. There are people that have it more brutal than others, for sure. Some people live in states where they have, you know, for all practical purposes, no disabilities or restraints, and then other people are just beat down and just constantly, all the living restrictions and supervision and restrictions and work restrictions and internet restrictions. Like, there's just a constant beating.
Well, you should have thought about that. You should have thought about that in 1987 before you did it.
Of course. This one's kind of funny to me. This one is from Reason.com. It says, Justice Department asks Supreme Court to block judge's order to release inmates at Ohio federal prison. So somebody's asking for them to go and someone else is blocking them? Is that the way that I'm reading this?
That is correct. The lawsuit has resulted in a district judge named James Gwynn, who believes that the situation is so dire that people need to be released. The judge has taken action, and the appeal is by the Department of Justice to try to get the Supreme Court to block what the judge is doing, because they claim that it's disrupting their orderly process of releasing people. But the only problem is they haven't released anybody. Very few.
Yeah, like a tenth of a percent of people have been. Actually, somewhere down the line of these articles, the only people that have been released, I shouldn't say only, but the high-profile people have been released, the Paul Manafort's and those kind of people have been released, were Joe Schmo, John Doe, Jane Doe. They are having troubles getting released.
And that's what this federal judge has tried to do something about, but like I say, the appeal was taken to the Supreme Court to try, and I haven't gone online trying to track this. This article was dated on the 21st, and it's possible the Supreme Court has already said, no, we're not going to intervene, or it's possible they could have intervened, but I don't know. Maybe the listeners can let us know, but this is your...
Anybody in chat wants to do some research for us on the fly here real quick. We'll get on it.
This is your Department of Justice at work.
And who appoints the Justice of the Department?
That would be the President of the United States.
Ah, so we get what we vote for. Is that what we're saying?
Well, I'm saying that the Attorney General appears to be saying things inconsistent with what the Department of Justice is doing. He publicly states that he wants the BOP to release people, but then his very department is standing in the way of the BOP releasing people. I'm suggesting there might be a little bit of duplicity here.
And is this like Supreme Court of the U.S. or Ohio Supreme Court? It's got to be SCOTUS.
Because
it's Ohio Federal Prison. It's not a state-level prison. Yep. Just wanted to make sure. And then we have over at the AP, Governor overruled Deputy Attorney General to deny prisoners unemployment. Larry, this, I don't even see how this would work. Just like, I don't necessarily think that having a job in prison is a privilege per se. But if you then go on and get laid off because of COVID, I don't see the conditions that you would collect unemployment in that. Like, you're not paid standard wages. So your unemployment would be, you know, here's your $5 a week unemployment check.
I didn't understand it that way. The way I interpret this, these were people working regular jobs these were work release jobs where they weren't working in prison industries. They were working in the community. It says Maine inmates whose work release jobs were suspended because of the pandemic were paid nearly $200,000 in unemployment benefits. And now we just got through, I tried to discreetly bash the National Administration with the Attorney General. Now, this is a Democrat governor. So I'm following the bashing of the Trump administration for being duplicitous with a very scathing bashing of a Democrat administration at the state level. If they were eligible for these benefits and they're on work release jobs in the community and they're not allowed to do these work release jobs, it seems like to me the governor, the Democrat governor is overstepping the Democrat governor's authority by squashing these benefits.
Because they're federal benefits.
Well, no, unemployment benefits by and large are state, and we could spend a whole show on this, but the basic benefits are paid by the employers into an insurance fund by contributions that are made based on the industry. Different industries have different contribution rates. Some industries have high levels of seasonality and layoffs, and they'll pay a higher rate of unemployment. Compensation insurance into the unemployment fund. And then you have the federal supplement, which has come about as a result of the pandemic. They have added the $600 a week to the basic state benefit. And then they've added a new eligibility group for the gig workers, because traditional unemployment, since it's paid by employers, if you're a gig worker, you're not paying into that system. So we have a new group of covered people that the feds are picking up. And then we have the $600 a week for each eligible person that the feds are picking up. But basic unemployment benefits are managed and funded at the state level.
Then why do you think she's overstepping her bounds?
Because Well, I mean, I haven't done great research into to Maine law, but I'm sure that the employers have contributed into this system. They're unemployed by no fault of their own, and that's the basic qualifications for the state benefits. It's not whether we like you or not, or whether we'd prefer that you not have them. If your employer has contributed into the system and you have a sufficient qualifying wages in the base period, which is usually four of the most five completed quarters, and you did not separate by fault of your own, you're entitled to benefits.
All right.
Now, there's one other component. One other component, usually you have to be able, available, and actively seeking work. Theoretically, right. if you're in prison on work release, you may not be actively seeking work, but they've suspended the actively seeking work during this pandemic, so most states are not enforcing the seeking work requirement. So therefore, I think she's overstepped her authority because the law provides for this. If she doesn't like this, she should call her legislature in session and ask that they change the law.
And also, like, we are paying people to stay home so that they don't need jobs for this period of time so that they're not out there like infecting everybody. I mean, that's like the whole point of the $600 and the 30 million. I don't remember the latest number, the 30 million people that are unemployed. I mean, like, the point of that is to keep them home and infecting all of humanity with the crud.
Well, it's 40 million now, but who's counting?
Is it okay?
It's like with Social Security benefits. When you're eligible based on one of the qualifying conditions, Social Security is not a means-tested program. Unemployment is not a means-tested program. It doesn't matter whether you need the money or not. If you file a claim and you're eligible, yes, it's one of those things where your employer has contributed to the system, and as long as you meet the requisite requirements of having the covered wages in the appropriate quarters, and you're able, available, and actively seeking work, you're entitled to the benefits for the duration. Now, the southern states like yours and particular North Carolina, they've reduced the basic 26-week package down to like 12 to 18 weeks because their theory is the faster you cut people's benefits off, the faster they'll find work. But the basic unemployment package runs 26 weeks. And then when we're in high times of unemployment, the feds typically supplement that by extending in 13-week increments. And like in the last recession, it was extended to where the basic package turned into 100 weeks of eligibility, which was just shy of 2 years.
Gotcha. Well, we'll see how this plays out then. Let's move over.
Well, I think someone's going to have to file a court challenge.
That could be a way to go.
Someone's going to have to file. Yep.
This next article comes from AJC.com, and the title is Former Georgia Governor Leads Push for Federal Criminal Justice Reform. I have to tell you, Larry, that I sat in on a couple sessions where there was like a criminal justice reform group here in Georgia, and someone sitting next to me goes, man, there's something about Nathan Deal, and he just really has he's just very determined to help people recover from prison and move on and do the right thing. And even though he was Team Red, he was very focused on some criminal justice things, and I only heard good things about him from that side of the equation. And so here he is trying to push that that ball, move the needle with a criminal justice reform task force.
Well, and due credit to former governor Deal from Georgia, he was one of those rare pragmatic Republicans that are harder and harder to find. And he did, in spite of being in a very conservative state, he did lead the charge towards criminal justice reform. And he really showed an enormous amount of courage when he vetoed the bathroom bill. After remember all the controversy we had about bathrooms?
I totally remember.
And the Georgia Assembly, falling dutifully in line, passed a bathroom that you will use the bathroom that's assigned on your birth certificate.
Uh-huh.
And now he vetoed that, and he did consider the adverse impact on business, but also if he had wanted to succumb to the wishes of the citizens of Georgia, he would have signed that because the citizens, as spoken through their lawmakers, they wanted that bill passed. Not everybody, but majority of Georgians were for that, and he vetoed it. So he's been an amazingly moderate person to serve in government, and I think he's ideally suited to lead this charge because he won't be accused of being a liberal do-gooder who's just hell-bent on turning people out of prison and releasing a tidal wave of crime on society. They will never attack a Republican for that. He has the credentials of credibility, and he's one of the best suited people for the job. And I'm glad he's in the position of that he is.
Perfect. And I wanted to put that right up against the Courthouse News article. It says Florida's pay-to-vote law ruled unconstitutional. We've talked about the difference of when it says that you will, I forgot the way that it words it, that you will pay all fines and fees and restitution before you will get your voting rights back. And you worded it differently. But so what is included? Like if it says all of the things, then don't you have to do all of the things? But they ruled that as being some kind of poll tax, that you have poor people that can't afford the lowest of fines and you have rich people that can afford all of the fines. And that sets up a discriminatory policy of who can vote and who cannot. So this judge said, can't do it, which I like.
Well, it is 125 pages. It's the longest I can recall in the history of the podcast of a decision. So therefore, I did a skim read in preparation today.
How dare you? It's double space. It only makes it like 60 pages.
Is that all? So the key points I think I briefly touched on, and the judge makes it clear on page 2, the order holds that the state can condition voting on payment of fines and restitution that a person is able to pay, but mm-hmm. cannot condition voting and payment on amounts a person is unable to pay or on payment of taxes, even those labeled fees or costs. And I went throughout it marking and highlights things that I thought were interesting. And as I started getting closer to the podcast, I started skimming even more. So I'm sure I missed some very important stuff. But what I figured out when reading this was that it wasn't so simple as the language actually looks like it favors the Republicans, who just was, according to the decision, was a straight party line vote that passed this in the legislature and was this was a straight partisan thing. But it looks like that the amendment was the language supports their position, because it says on page 8, except as provided in subsection B, any disqualification from voting arising from a felony conviction shall terminate, and voting rights shall be restored upon completion of all terms of sentence, including parole or probation. Now, that begs the question, if you only cared about probation or parole, why did you put in there all terms of sentence? What does all terms mean?
It could be like classes as another thing, sort of treatment kinds of classes or DUI classes, things of that nature.
Well, couldn't it be economic as well? Could it be restitution? Couldn't it be fines?
Totally. But doesn't that... So I saw people in treatment that they couldn't pay and the doctor would still see them. He just added it to their bill and they wouldn't graduate, if you want to call it graduate, whatever, wouldn't terminate the class until they had paid all the fees owed. But some people got a pretty significant discount based on their economic standings.
So, well, but back to the importance of drafting. This was a constitutional amendment, something you were going to put in the Constitution of Florida. Why did you not make it clear what all obligations, all terms of sentence? Because clearly you didn't just care about parole or probation, because you would have just said upon completion of parole or probation. What did you mean by all terms of sentence?
Was it not worded that they just rolled the Fourth Amendment back? Like they just said, hey, let's just take this out. Because, I mean, the Fourth Amendment was like, hey, if you're a felon, no voting for you, period. And 2/3 of the voters in Florida reversed that in 2018.
Yeah, 64.5%, I think it was. Okay. Almost two-thirds. But again, I'm struggling on the drafting.
Yeah.
How is it? A Constitution amendment is important stuff. You're changing the Constitution of either the United States or the state of Florida. If it was that important to change the Constitution, why is it not clear what you meant? Why did you leave so much ambiguity? But in the trial, which this wasn't decided by summary judgment, they actually had an old-fashioned trial on this. It came out in trial that it was impossible to figure out what people owed.
Right.
Because of all the accounts being sold, the judgment's not being available, depending on the age of the case, how they calculated interest into it. If part of the lien had been collected, how much it had been properly recorded to the county, and did they get credit for the amount they paid, or just the amount that the system retrieved because the collection agency got a cut? There were just all these problems in trying to figure out, even if you're going to interpret it to include financial obligations, how do we know what you owe? How do we know what you've paid? And how do we deal with the fact if you can't pay? And it was just so haphazardly done for a constitutional amendment that the state, of course, argued that if you strike the thing, then the whole constitutional amendment has to fall. We go back to status quo, and the judge said, "Nope, doesn't work like that." Right. So,
and what do you think about the impact that this particular ordeal has against at least the surrounding states, if not all 73? How many states do we have now? It's somewhere up there. I know that it's supposed to impact the directly connecting states fairly significantly, because I think they have similar prohibitions from people, not necessarily like just prohibited from voting, but you have to pay your fines and fees and stuff before you can get voting rights back.
Well, this would directly affect the 11th Circuit, which is Georgia, Florida, and Alabama. That this case is going to be appealed. There's absolutely no doubt in my mind. I will unequivocally say that Governor DeSantis will insist that this be appealed with all the vigor that the state of Florida can muster, because we have got to get this liberal lifetime Clinton-appointed judge overturned at the 11th Circuit. And the 11th Circuit is, as all professional accounts, much more conservative. In fact, I think there's one or two justices formerly that DeSantis had appointed to the state court have now been appointed to the 11th Circuit by President Obama. So he will want the opportunity to argue in front of his judges. So there's no doubt in my mind this will be appealed.
I do understand. And I think that we have a companion article. It says a game changer, 5 takeaways from Sunday's ruling on felon voting. Just expands on what we've just been talking about.
That's what it was in there. But another solution is to say, well, we don't restore anyone. And that's the risk of this, is that it's like when you do good, you're the Park versus state of Georgia with the GPS monitoring.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the legislature comes back and they're going to pass a law to put it in the statute again.
Right.
If the 11th Circuit does not affirm the district judge, if they overturn the district judge, we're back to square one. But if they don't overturn the district judge, if they affirm and uphold the district judge, what the people in Florida that are so dead set against felon voters, because they said in the trial, they read transcripts, that this appeared to be fear of Democrat votes, because everybody knows, according to what came out in trial, this is not Larry saying this, but what came out in trial was that these people, these African Americans, they all vote Democrat, and everybody knows that. It may be that they don't want to take the chance of having Democrat voters, so they just may not enact a new statute. You may not be able to get something like this enacted again. They may demagogue this so much. I mean, we don't know how this is going to play out. All we know is that a bad amendment was adopted. It was not clear what the intent was. We know that the Florida legislature passed a bill to put it to what they thought that was intended and what satisfied them, and they got the governor's signature. And we know that that a district federal judge has said it's unconstitutional what the legislature did. That's what we know, but we don't know where this is going.
Of course not. Well, I think we should let people vote. It's just my opinion.
Not when they're going to vote Democrat.
Ah, yes, because that would make them bad.
Of course it would.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
How about an article over at Courthouse News? 4 Minneapolis officers fired after death of a black man. Like, huh,
What is this all about, Larry?
Well, this is one of the saddest things we'll be talking about tonight. This in Minneapolis. I suspect probably every listener knows what we're talking about.
Probably.
And I suspect that that this may be a game changer in terms of what we do about police misconduct. But we have talked about police misconduct throughout the history of this program. And in fact, I think you have a little special for people, how much we've talked about it, don't you?
And I know for certain that things were missed, because after I put all this together, I was thinking of the time where the cop like tased the kid and his head like smashed on the ground. I didn't find that one. I did some snazzy Google searches and put this together. So about 2 minutes long. Episode 69, recorded March 24th, 2019.
And another article from The Appeal is, Albany police shot a teen in the back and paralyzed him. The DA said it was justified. So I think that if you run away from the police, they have the right to shoot you.
I don't see a problem with it. Let's go into the next article.
Episode 106, recorded December 15th, 2019.
A police officer shot a fleeing teen. It was his second on-duty killing in less than a year. This is from the Washington Post.
Episode 39, recorded August 27th, 2018.
From The Guardian, and hundreds dead, no one charged, the uphill battle against the Los Angeles police killing. Tell us about this one.
Well, I put it in here because it gives me a chance to pontificate about the citizens, but the real purpose of it was to draw attention to the huge number of citizens that are killed across this country at the hands of law enforcement and how nonchalant we are about it. It's like, I believe the count was 370 in the article.
Episode 113, recorded February 2nd, 2020.
A police corporal in Maryland was charged with second-degree murder on Tuesday in the fatal shooting of a suspect who had been handcuffed in the front passenger seat of his patrol car the previous night. Why do we let cops kill people when they're handcuffed? I'm still baffled by this whole thing all the time.
Well, I don't think we're letting them do it. I think you read the article. He's been charged. The question
he has
is,
been. So that would be the sort of like the weird part of this is that somebody is actually getting charged with something.
Well, that's the point I was going to make. Whether it be convicted. Convicting a police officer is very, very difficult.
Episode 108, recorded December 29th, 2019.
All right, this next article comes from the Washington Post. Police slammed a man's head into a car that they thought he had stolen video shows. And then he died.
Episode 74, recorded April 28th, 2019.
Let's head on over to Baltimore, where... I don't know how this guy actually survived. How did the police shoot at a guy 44 times? And forgive me for the way I'm going to be blunt. How does this guy not die?
I think they hope he does or did.
So that's the little montage of how many times, it's like, I don't know, half dozen, eight times that we've talked about people being to some degree assaulted or died in the police, in the hands of the police.
I remember we had one where a student was body slammed by a police school resource officer. Which
that's true. Oh, man, police. I totally. You're right. You're right. Yes.
And we've got a problem, which we're going to try to dissect a little bit. But the problem is really us. When you look in your mirror each day, the problem is in that mirror. We have not been willing to impose control on our police. They have been able to do this without any accountability. And the police are not going to be able to impose that control on themselves. We are going to have to rise to the occasion and tell the police what they're allowed to do and what they're not allowed to do. And if they do what they're not allowed to do, we're going to have to impose discipline up to and including putting them in prisons. And that's what it's going to take. And this violence in Atlanta is really personal to me because that's so close to my home. And I know we've got some clips I wanted to play from the mayor of Atlanta because I want to make it clear, Registry Matters doesn't condone violence. Neither does the mayor of Atlanta or any mayor that I'm aware of. But I want to give some context to what has brought us to this point. And so can we roll the clip of Mayor Bottoms from Atlanta?
Absolutely. Here we go.
If you care about this city, then go home and pray that somebody like Reverend Beasley will come and talk to you and give you some instructions on what a protest should look like and how you effectuate change. And this police chief made a video on yesterday, pull it up on YouTube, where she said she was appalled to watch the murder of George Floyd. This woman did that. You're not honoring the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. and the civil rights movement. You're not protesting anything, running out with brown liquor in your hands, breaking windows in this city. T.I. and Killer Mike own half the West Side. So when you burn down this city, you're burning down our community. If you want change in America, go and register to vote. Show up at the polls on June 9th. Do it in November. That is the change we need in this country. You are disgracing our city. You are disgracing the life of George Floyd and every other person who has been killed in this country.
Go out and vote, huh, Larry?
That was the point of that. She was very eloquent. She went on to this was not just talking down to calling people thugs, which we're going to hear from a former Obama administration official in the next clip. And although we don't condone violence and we prefer that things be resolved through our processes, what do people do when the processes are not able to respond and to resolve or even address these issues? So let's listen to Van Jones now.
Hurt people holler. Hurt people holler. And one of the things that we're dealing with right now is it's hard to speak up when you see injustice, when things are going wrong, when a department first starts to go sour, when you start seeing things that don't make sense. But if you speak up and you're not heard, then you might shout. If you shout and then you're still not heard, then you might scream. If you scream and you're still not heard, then you might throw something. Look at your own children and how they act. When there's something desperately wrong and no one will listen, people go to more and more extreme forms of expression and then of action. Not to justify it, but that's there. So if you are concerned about lawlessness, and by the way, I'm raising two black boys in Los Angeles. I'm not a part of any pro-riot lobby or any pro-crime lobby. I want peaceful streets. But I know that if I want to end lawlessness in LA, I've got to make sure there is not lawlessness in the police precincts in LA.
So there's Van Jones.
And there's the frustration, because as I was doing research for this, we have an article from the New York Times. The last time this country was focusing on police abuse was back in 2014 when Obama was president. And in the preceding year of 2013, this article from the Times talks about police killings. Now, folks, we're just talking about the police who have killed citizens. We're not talking about the tasings. We're not talking about the pepper spray. We're not talking about the smashings on the hood of the car. We're not talking about the pretextual arrest that are. We're not talking about all the type. We're just talking about people who have died at the hands of police. There were 1,111 in 2013, according to the Times. In 2019, which is the most recent data we have, there was 1,099. So we've had, through the intervening years, 1,050 to 1,100 people killed at the hands of the police. That means that all the screams, all the talking, all of the protests that were peaceful have yielded absolutely no discernible result. What do you expect people to do after 7 years of this being on the forefront of, we've got to do something about what the police are doing in our cities, and in 7 years later, there's been no discernible change? It would be natural to expect people to exhibit some level of frustration. Again, don't burn up buildings, don't break windows, but it would be rational to expect people to be frustrated.
So 2013 marks a significant event. I think that would be the year prior to, and I'm sure there were wrongful type deaths before this, but somehow Eric Garner became, we'll call it case number one, maybe. This was the dude in New York that was selling cigarettes on the street, and he got put in the chokehold, and he's saying, "I can't breathe, I can't breathe," and there's six officers surrounding him as he gets choked out and dies. So like, I'm sure that's not case number one, and I don't want to be insensitive to that, but that seems to be like where this whole thing started, is with that particular person. So 2013 in the graph that I have up on the screen is showing 1,111 deaths in 2013. And the number hasn't appreciably changed in the following years after 2013.
And that was in the era when we had Laquan McDonald in Chicago and Tamir Rice in Cleveland. We had these high profile cases that made national news. And then the Ferguson case, I forget the name of the one in Ferguson, Missouri, but there was quite an uproar. And we had President Obama, who tried to bring the Department of Justice, the powers of the federal government, and on these local agencies that were violating people, citizens' civil rights. And in my city of Albuquerque, we ended up having our police department ended up, we were having a large number of police shootings. I think we had something on the order of 30 within about a 13-month period of time here. And the DOJ came in here. We have made dramatic reforms. The police department here has changed a lot of their protocols in terms of how they deploy force. They've got a long way to go, but things are a lot better than they were. But this administration, the Trump administration, has called off the attack dogs. They say that we need to let the police themselves.
I was just going to ask you about that.
It's absolutely the wrong thing to do.
Can you expand on that? As I understand it, during the previous administration, they had started to some degree, like the federal level was investigating the city and the state level police units. And that all got shut down. Jeff Sessions like, hey, we're going to turn all that shit off. And they shut all of those investigations down.
That is correct. Now, the decrees that were already entered into are still in force, like the one with the Albuquerque police. But they are not seeking out any police misconduct at the federal level for civil rights investigations. This administration believes it's best left to the locals. And therefore, we're going to probably have a continued level of maybe, hopefully this will get their attention. I can't speak for the administration, but I'm hoping that it does get their attention. But the reason why the Obama administration was in these communities doing these investigations is because the locals have not done what they need to do to oversee their police. It's you in Louisville. It's you that elect the city councilors. It's you who elect the mayor. It's those people who decide how the police department operates. And they have abdicated that responsibility all across the country. They believe that police operations are too complicated for civilian oversight. And therefore, we let the police the police. And we see what we get from this result. The police are not capable of policing themselves.
And well, who should oversee it, Larry? Should it be Mother Teresa that oversees the police?
Well, I don't have the exact model, but it should be civilian oversight. The police are accountable to the citizens they serve, and the citizens they deserve that they provide service to should be the ones who tell them what type of equipment they can use, what the rules of engagement are, whether you can choke a person out with a particular hold or not. Those should be things that we decide. We will not allow you to do this. We will not allow you to handcuff anybody less than a certain age. These are our rules for society. And if you don't like these rules, there's a solution for you. Don't put on the uniform. Don't become a police officer for this city. It's not that complicated. If you believe you should be able to handcuff a 9-year-old, then go work for a department that allows that. We don't allow that here.
Grief. Yeah. We did have one of those too, didn't we? I forgot about that.
Oh, yes.
He was younger than 9. The girl was like screaming for mom and dad. And like, that wasn't even that long ago. Totally forgot about that one.
Yeah, we've had, and the citizens somehow believe that they should not take control of their police. And I don't understand where that comes from. And I would like for a person on the other side to chime in with us and tell us why it is we're not capable of overseeing the police. We oversee the United States military. President Trump gives the orders. The generals follow the orders. The Secretary of Defense is a civilian. But for some reason, we're not capable of overseeing our law enforcement? Really?
I got to think that our military is at least some tiny little bit more complicated than the police forces.
So, well, but, it's been...
Let me throw this at you. I'm thinking about this off the cuff, though. Like, we have a federal armed forces that is only under the most extreme circumstances. They are not allowed to be on American soil to deal with... That's why we have National Guards. Because they are not trained, they are not equipped to handle our civilians. So that's why we deploy them overseas to handle like big boy stuff, I guess you could say. But the police force, like they have the little slogans on the cars that's supposed to say to serve and to protect. I think serve means like, hey, you serve me as the citizen. And then to protect, you're supposed to protect me. You're not supposed to put your knee in my neck and choke me out. That's not serving or protecting.
Well, Andy, I agree. And I see a glimmer of hope in this with the silver lining that as you know, I listen to a lot of conservative points of view. I don't just listen to one point of view. And I heard on the Rush Limbaugh program, which I believe is the most listened to radio program in America, at least he purports to be, with a weekly audience of 50 million.
I can see that he is.
He has not justified that. Rush is typically able to justify what the police do. He was not able to justify. He had a guest host this last week because he's got health issues. He's got lung cancer, and the poor guy is in a lot of struggle for his life. But he had a guest host, and the guest host usually are lockstep with law enforcement. The guest host, I forget his name, last Thursday, was not able to justify. We've got a former in New Mexico, former sheriff of Bernalillo County, and the cabinet secretary for the Department of Public Safety, which would encompass the state police force here. He unequivocally on his talk show made it clear that this is not justified, and he's disappointed. Darren White is who I'm talking about. Darren made it clear that he didn't understand why other officers did not intervene, and he feels like there's criminal culpability. And to Darren's credit, and I have not been a big Darren fan, but to Darren's credit, he was very reasonable on this, and he's been very reasonable on his talk show in terms of the COVID-19 and being fair to all the officials. He has not been partisan. He has been right down the middle, and he has emerged as the moderate on a station that is notoriously conservative on KKOB. he's the moderate. Now, picture that. The former sheriff, the former cabinet secretary for the Department of Public Safety, being the moderate on the largest listened to station in New Mexico, KKOB.
Tell me your thoughts on this, and we have a few more points to go over before we close out on this one. Why do you think it is that this event has have the cup runneth over, so to speak? I mean, we've been talking about this for years, and finally, this seems to be the one that has brought everyone to the forefront. I saw a picture of, a bunch of white women standing in front of a line of police officers, like they built a human wall between the police and the protesters, which is kind of ridiculous on its own, but it just goes to show about some white privilege in the United States that the police are not going to go attack a bunch of white women, but the protesters behind there are now being protected by a bunch of white women, which is ridiculous.
I think it's a combination of things that have come together. The first is this one is so blatant. There are a lot of apologists for the police that want to, the average citizen who considers himself a law and order person, they see the police as the only defense between them and anarchy. And they do believe anarchy is just around the corner. They do not realize that the crime rate has been plummeting and this is the safest time to be alive. The average middle-class white person doesn't realize that. But there's no denying this. You can't watch a person suffocate and their life just evaporate in front of your eyes, and it's hard to continue to justify that. Now, I did talk to an acquaintance of mine who did want to justify it, who said that he would like to see the rest of the video. And I said, well, there is no more video unless the police has it. This was video captured by a bystander, and this is all that they got when they got on the situation. But if the police are following their protocols and using their body cams, they can release whatever video they have. But I think that it's a culmination of the political season. You do not want to be on the wrong side of this coming into an election cycle. And so this has struck at the core. The media is all over it. It's undeniable that this is wrong. And I think that the politicians are going to have a hard time ignoring this. And I think that's what's come together in this. And even middle-class America, who wants to find a reason to justify the police, they're having a hard time watching a person be deprived of their life when they're in handcuffs face down. What can you say?
I want to make sure to acknowledge one of our listeners, like a very loyal, longtime listener here in the state with me, and I'll leave him anonymous, that he saw someone, I don't know the circumstance, but he saw someone murdered in prison, and he is likening this to something along those lines, and he's having like very severe issues, and he's very upset. This has really like messed him up, and I just want to make sure to acknowledge that this video, if you do, I don't want to watch it, frankly, Larry. I saw clips of it, and I'm not trying to say that I don't care. I certainly care. But I don't want to have these images in my head either. But I certainly want to recognize that people are having, this is some really tough stuff to try and digest.
It is. And what's really particularly sad for me is that with the existing police oversight in Minneapolis, apparently, if the reports are accurate, he had been, this officer, the primary actor, was his name Chauvin. He had been reported to for 18 paternal affairs investigations. Now, I think we can conclude at some point, you're going to get complaints no matter how nice you are. There are going to be people who are going to make complaints to try to gain an advantage. So therefore, every complaint has to be start with the presumption that the officer didn't do anything wrong, and the evidence is yours to bear as the accusing party. I stand with that. But after 18 of them, if that's accurate, at some point, police management ought to be asking what is going on with this officer, because 18 is representative of hundreds more that didn't file complaints, because you have no faith in this system that it's going to do anything to remedy your complaint. Only a few people would file complaints, so this would be indicative of a large amount of issues with this police officer. Why didn't administration do anything?
Yeah, there's so many questions surrounding, because even in like the little montage that I did where we covered the cop in California, that this was his second killing in a year, I think it was, the way that it was worded, which is insane that we have a armed and shielded, like physically shielded, but then on the other side of that, when they end up somehow being questioned and challenged in if their actions were justified, then either the police administration won't do anything about it. And then if they are brought to court in some kind of way, they will not be indicted. And if they're brought to court all the way through, the jury will not convict them. I mean, it's like all the way from the top to the bottom, there's nothing being done to the officers, which kind of in a roundabout way would say, go forth and do what you want to do, because no one's going to hold your hand and put your feet to the fire.
That is true. Now, this particular case, I can't help but reverting back to my defense orientation. It's going to be really hard for this officer to get a fair trial. I mean, the public opinion is so massive, and he has every right to a fair trial. He doesn't have to plead guilty, and they're not going to even offer him a plea bargain. The only way he could plead would be straight up and down to the charge, but they're not going to offer him any inducement to plead. And this is one of those cases where you just can't offer a plea, any type of favorable terms for a plea. But he's entitled to robust representation. He's entitled to the presumption of innocence. It's supposed to follow him to the conclusion of the proceedings. And he's entitled to cross-examine vigorously anyone who's coming in to testify against him. He's entitled to all these things. And I will say that unequivocally, and I'll always revert back to, I wish the police would say the same thing about someone who's outside the uniform, who's accused of a crime. I wish they would be as adamant as I am about what this man is entitled to. He is an innocent person. Even though we saw what we saw in the eyes of the law, he is still innocent until that gavel comes down and the jury verdict has read. And if it's guilty, he is to be presumed he's innocent all the way to the conclusion of the proceeding. And that's just the way our system is supposed to work. And he is not re-victimizing anybody if he cross-examines people who testify against him. That is not a victimization. That's forcing the state to prove the charges beyond a reasonable doubt.
Will is adamant that I ask you this question. Do you think that the people that have released videos of it, do you think that there's any sort of risk that they will be retaliated against by the police force?
Sure, there's always that risk. I don't know that they'd be able to determine how the video, because I think it was, well, I guess you could figure out who, if it was posted on Facebook initially, I guess you could figure out who, but to the extent that the police can figure it out, they're going to be hard pressed to do anything to these people officially. But what about the unofficial stuff? What about the pretextual engagement and just the harassment? You know, you were going 36 into 35.
Right, exactly.
And I don't know what you can do about that. Hopefully that this case will resolve itself and justice is done. And hopefully that this will be a beginning of a trend towards us asserting control over our police forces in this country. Folks, you can't just stand back and idly wait for it to fix itself. It is not going to fix itself. It cannot fix itself.
So some threads of the chat. I mean, like, chat is super lively tonight, Larry, and I know you don't watch it, but holy crap, it's very popular. Hey, over on the Discord server, if you want to engage in chat with us, then you can find links in the show notes to enjoy chatting with all of us and people peppering questions. But so I forget which quote it was from the mayor or the other gentleman that spoke about voting. Like, voting has consequences, but Teresa is saying that this is so far beyond voting to get this stuff fixed. And while I don't want to discount Teresa's fury over this, I don't know how else we do fix this. If we don't have our elected people to trickle down what is acceptable so that our sheriffs trickle down what is acceptable and so forth. Like, to me, this is the only thing to me is our voting is the avenue that we have to fix this.
I understand where she's coming from, that when it's this bad and this systemic, you're looking for a silver bullet, but there really isn't one. There's no silver bullet like there is in our issue. There's no silver bullet for fixing this. This is going to involve each police agency is managed in a different way. You may have the chief of police may be solely hired by the mayors in our case, or it may be that they need city council or city alderman or whatever they call them in your particular city approval. In the case of sheriff's offices, they're generally elected. So you have all these different mechanisms that bring that are going to require a different type of fix. If it's the mayor that appoints the police chief and it's his or her decision entirely, well, then you're going to have to ask the mayor the candidates for mayor these tough questions. But it is the political process. It is the taxpayers who fund the police, and it's the taxpayers who make the rules. The police only get to make the rules because we are allowing that to happen. The police cannot bring any equipment on the streets of Albuquerque that we do not allow them to have. It's not their decision whether they have tanks operating on the streets of Albuquerque. That's our decision. It's not their decision whether they have helicopters. It's our decision. It's not their decision about how they engage with citizens in terms of standard operating procedures. We've delegated the SOPs, the creation of SOPs to the police, but ultimately we can control those processes. We can tell them, these are the SOPs. These are what you will do. And I understand you don't need to send me emails. There will be some people who will resent that and they will not want to be a police officer. That is good, because you do not want people who do not want to be subject to civilian oversight being a police officer. So therefore, I say, knock yourself out and go to someplace else, because we will be able to fund, we will be able to fill our police openings with qualified candidates as you are leaving. Trust me, there are way more applicants, far more people apply that get accepted, and they get turned down for a number of reasons, including minor criminality, physical fitness, mental fitness, and sometimes they're just not fast enough on the draw when they do the simulation training, when they do the testing to find out if you'd be alive or dead as a cop. Right. And the systems tend to weed out people who don't fire quickly enough. Who's to say that wouldn't have been a good police officer?
Right.
So we may need to start revamping how we allow people to go through the process. We might need to open it up to people who are a little bit older, might be a little bit chubbier. They might be more representative of the community. We might need to, and in fact, I'm going to say this, we might need more women on the police forces, because you don't hear of men of women officers doing this. I'm not saying we're pierced the wind-driven snow, but I have not, of anything we've covered, I don't think we've covered a fatal shooting of a female officer. I don't think we've covered a body slamming or anything about this. We're always covering men when we're talking about this stuff. So maybe that's part of the answer.
Maybe. So we should institute some sort of quota of something close to 50-50?
Well, I don't know if quotas drive people bananas, but I think that our police ought to be more representative of the community. And being that women make up 50%+ of the population, we should do our best to represent that population. We should do our best to represent all the community that's being policed. If the community is half black, we shouldn't have a 95% white police force. That's not representative of the community. And that's what a lot of southern cities have. You'll have a community that's 40% black, and the police force will be 85% white.
But Larry, we can't even let women go to combat. And I know that has changed, but just bear with me and roll the clock back to the 90s. We can't let women go to combat. We can't have them be police officers too, can we?
Sure we can.
Do you think there is a sinister, a cynical motivation here of of the politicians getting on board with this, you know, like Senator Rand Paul, I mean, that's probably more like just in his wheelhouse of the no-knock warrant, but all of the other politicians getting on board and denouncing this particular action, do you think it's because of the November election, you know, 6 months away from now, being such a big deal that we're going to court the black vote by saying that this is something that we shouldn't do, is kill, run around and kill black people?
I think that there's every risk of that happening, because I mentioned that earlier, that we are in an election cycle. And I think that that's helped politicians now feel the need to go out and take a strong position, because this has connected with the people. There's certain cases that connect with the people, and I can't explain it. Some of the media gurus that we have. Why does Jessica Lynch catch the attention of America like did in the Gulf War? Why? Right. I mean, her team was, she wasn't the entire team. There was a whole group of people on that team that was some correct kind of transport convoy, if I remember right.
Yes, you are right. She was a cute white girl. That's why she. That's same thing with JonBenet Ramsey. That's Jessica Lunsford. Is that who the?
Yes, Lunsford daughter. Yes. I forget that's the first name.
Yeah, that's I think we have a pretty identified bias towards cute blonde-haired white girls in the country. And yeah, send all your hate mail at me. I'm sorry, but that is typically like a gender race bias that we have in the United States too.
Well, clearly this is not a cute white blonde-haired boy, but true, this has connected with the people, and I think the egregiousness is like most Americans think that they're fair and that they're open-minded. We right all think that. We think that. And your life experience precludes you from understanding a lot of things you've not experienced. You and I don't experience much interference with the police in our daily lives. We don't have to explain why we're at a particular location. We don't have to open our trunk and let our and consent to an inspection. We don't encounter all this. So in our mind, it's okay. And most of the time, you'll have to admit that all of your encounters with the police have been reasonably professional. I know when I've been pulled over, I look back decades ago when I first started driving, every time I've encountered a traffic officer, by and large, they've been very professional. So our relationship with the police is not the same as the people in these communities of color, where they don't get the same treatment that we get. So as far as the Americans that have not encountered any of these problems, they're invisible. They don't see it the same way. But they saw that. They can't deny it. They saw a compliant individual in handcuffs, yeah, with his face at the pavement being suffocated. And you can't make excuses for that anymore.
No, it seems. I really struggle with he was resisting. He was face down with cuffs behind his back. I like, you can't get up quickly. I mean, unless you're Jackie Chan, some sort of ninja warrior, perhaps you can like skirmish your way out. No, that's not typically, nobody's going to be able to resist effectively in that kind of condition.
Well, one of the police officers, according to the articles, I forget which one of the four we've got here, but one of the police officers said we need to roll him over and we need to get him, you know, so he can breathe. And the officer Chauvin apparently didn't think much of that advice. My question is, why didn't you take it to the next level? Why didn't you say back off?
Chokehold.
Yeah, so it's like you have a duty to protect, and at the point where you see the suspect is compliant and life is in jeopardy, I think you had a duty to intervene. And a citizen called in on the Rush Limbaugh, oh, not the Rush Limbaugh, the Darren White show, and asked what would have happened if he had intervened. And Darren White said it would not have been good. It would not have been pretty what would have happened if you'd have tried to intervene, particularly if you were a male. You might have gotten a little bit of slack if you had been a woman, but if a man tried to pounce in there and pull the cop off, that would not have been a pretty sight.
The only other thing, and I, you know, we've been talking about this a while, we can put this to rest here shortly. We talked briefly on the phone earlier today about like why didn't any of the people that were observing? I don't know how many people were there observing this whole thing go down. But we started talking briefly about the bystander effect, that everyone standing there is like, well, maybe somebody else will do something about it. If you're the only one that is witnessing something like this, then you have the inclination to go, well, no one's going to do anything but me, so I will go jump in there. But when there's 50 other people standing there, you're always sort of like nudging the person next to you, like, hey, step in there and do something. And so nobody steps in and does anything because everybody's waiting for someone else to go do it.
That is true. And the same thing happens in reverse. When someone does something, then you have the mob mentality can set in. And that's why the police would not have been receptive to any intervention. They would have escalated dramatically if the citizens had started interfering.
It
would not have been pretty. You would have had to have been an older person and probably an older woman. And if you could have screamed and scratched enough, they might not would have tased an old woman. But again, they might would have. So.
All right. Well, we can move on. I'm deeply infuriated by this again, because it's just ridiculous that it continues to happen. All right. Well, a couple last articles. From ProPublica, Bill Barr promised to release prisoners threatened by coronavirus, even as the Fed secretly made it harder for them to get out. This is related, I believe, to the First Step Act. And did I catch that one right? Or did I confuse this with something else?
Nope, you got it. You got it right. It's correct.
Hooray! And so there are reasons that people should be able to get out for some compassionate release. And I think Bill Barr is trying to help that move along, but then other places are not. So nobody's getting out.
Well, I wouldn't say nobody. I think they let...
Okay.
I think, was it 0.2% or something?
Yes, it's low number.
Wait, it says fewer prisoners have been released than was expected when the Attorney General made his announcement. About 3,050 inmates have been moved to home confinement as of May 21st. That's around 1.8% of the people in the Bureau of Supervision. That figure is significantly smaller than roughly 20% who fall into the minimum risk category. Now, when we say minimum risk, we're talking about your security classification. If you if you're convicted of a sexual offense, you can only get as low as medium in the federal system. You cannot be at a minimum camp because of the community safety factor, that you might start going off the prison campus and perving in the community. So we can't have that. So the people who would fit within the risk group of having potential complications from the virus, that 20%, they're nowhere near that. They're at 1.8%. So they got to one-tenth of what of the people who already excludes our people. They're not eligible to even be considered.
So the bottom line is you get put behind the walls and there's not much that could happen, including a global pandemic, that will help you get released.
And the point of my sneaky motivation was putting in here is because a lot of our people are very fond of the Trump administration, and they think that the Trump administration is doing all it can, because when you listen to the Attorney General's pronouncements, but the Attorney General's Department of Justice is the Bureau of Prisons is a part of the Department of Justice, and the Bureau is not doing what the Attorney General is saying. So either we have an Attorney General who's duplicitous, or we have an insubordinate BOP director and BOP administration. But the BOP is doing very little, and they're in fact making it harder, according to some analysis. And I couldn't quite follow exactly what they're doing, but the implementation of the First Step Act, they apparently are making it harder. But certainly, there's no massive number of people being released. 3,000 is a paltry amount. It's significant. If you're one of the 3,000, it's very significant.
Oh, certainly, certainly, certainly. Just like you bring up your New Mexico riot thing. If you got out on the 28th, I think, of February versus the 29th, you had a much better day.
You had a much better day.
All right, then to close things out, we have an article from the Indiana Lawyer. It says, removal from sex offender registry makes man's case moot. Larry, this one has some flipping back and forth like a game of Othello, and it confuses me, and I really hope that you can clarify what's going on here.
Well, it's very simple, Andy.
So you say.
It is. He was convicted in Maine, and he moved to Indiana. And he was required to register because Indiana determined he was substantially similar to the main offense. But then he challenged that because of some litigation in Indiana that dealt with ex post facto, and the court disagreed with him and said you have to register, not because of the out of state interpretation. You have to register because your crime is a registrable offense here. Well, the state decided to go back and look at the substantial similarity, and they decided that he did no longer have to register. So therefore, his case was mooted, which is a very, very fond trick that the state does. If you start gaining traction with your litigation, they find a way to give you the relief, which makes the case no longer relevant. There's no longer what is called a justiciable controversy because the person that he's no longer having to register. So the state of Indiana mooted his case. They said, whoops, well, on closer review, it's not such an equivalent offense, and you don't have to register. So we're going to remove you from the registry. So then there was a joint motion filed by both sides saying that the controversy has ended. So the court had no prerogative but to say, yep, the controversy's over.
So does he or does he not still have to register?
He doesn't have to register. He had already gotten relief. He'd already gotten relief in Maine by a litigation from some years ago. They had a series of decisions in Maine. But since he wasn't living there, the Maine couldn't release him from Indiana's registration requirement. And that's the misconception right. A lot of people have. Well, I got off the registry. Oh, well, it doesn't do anything because you're not in that state. If you want to be off the registry in the state to let you off, stay in that state.
Right. Okay. But, the way that this was sort of worded to me, the way it looks, is that they almost like pulled the rug out from underneath him, and then he still had to register, but they removed the conditions. Like, I don't know. It was very confusing.
Yeah, they removed him from the registry in the joint motion to dismiss the case because of mootness, and that happens. I think it's more common. I think it happened in Maryland on a class action that they tried to get certified, and the state removed everybody and asked for the court to dismiss it, and the court obligingly did. And the same thing is similar is happening to our case on out of state translations. Here we've lost all of our plaintiffs, and our case is going to be mooted out potentially very soon. And it's part of the litigation. And you can argue exception to the mootness doctrine, but why would you want to? If you're wanting to get your client off the registry and the state capitulates and says he's off the registry, why would you want to keep litigating? The case is over. You won.
Absolutely. Sure. Perfect. Perfect. Brian in Louisiana in chat said he's on his way out to do offshore work again. And he said this before he departed. He said, Registry Matters is the number one live podcast in the Gulf of Mexico, Larry. How about that?
In the whole Gulf of Mexico?
The whole Gulf of Mexico. He puts up a hotspot and pays like big bucks so that he can listen to us do the live stream out there on his way out offshore. I thought that was an amazing compliment there. Can you imagine how many other programs we're competing with in the Gulf of Mexico?
Yeah, we have thousands of listeners in the Gulf of Mexico, I'm sure.
Could be true. Could be true. What else do we have to cover before we get out? Am I forgetting anything, Larry? Oh, you know what we have to cover? Our special guest that we were going to have this week was Christian. And
I see he's here.
Yes, he is here. And oddly, he lives in Minnesota, and there's some kind of craziness going on there. And with his particular job, that there was extra work. So anyway, he arrived an hour late. So we're going to kick him back to next week and try and do that over next week and have him as a guest.
That sounds fantastic.
6th or something like that, I think, is next week. Yeah, the 6th.
So can we have Lloyd on with us?
Sure. You're Lloyd in New Mexico?
No, his Lloyd.
Oh, I mean, like, okay. Yeah, I guess. I didn't know that we were doing a twofer. But yeah, that's fine.
I was waiting for him to be. We're not going to get Lloyd to come on. That Lloyd's not going to come on. He's a federal house. I think he's still in the House of Representatives, right, Christian?
Oh, is that right? All right. I don't know if he's going to respond in chat. So, Larry, where can people find show notes? They can find links to the articles. They can find anything else. Where do people have to go to find those things?
They need to go online.
Online, like AOL, like you have mail?
That would be one place. Or you could go to registrymatters.co.
Perfect. Registrymatters.co. And I know that you love it when people leave voicemail. How would people dial in and leave some voicemail?
Well, you go to your grandmother's closet and you find the old telephone that she's got stored in a box. It's black and it has a circular thingy on it. Well, I guess they call that a rotary dial. And you plug it into an outlet at grandma's house and you start dialing the numbers. You dial 1-747-227-4477.
Now, I have a quick little detour story for you about this. When I first started getting into computers, I had a modem, and you could configure how it would dial. So, you know, your rotary phone would be like, that's about how fast it would do the little clicks to register the phone number. You could change that configuration so you could make it go faster than the phone company could pick up. So you would have to find some sort of specific range where it would still pick up the digits. So you would make it like really, really, really fast at dialing, even though it was dialing with a rotary signal. How about that?
I remember those days.
Oh, yeah. And did you, how did, about
did,
what?
Did you ever have a box
No, I never did any blue, gray, black. I never did any of those boxes. But I, that's a whole other conversation. How about sending in some email, Larry? Where do people send email?
They send it to registrymatterscast@gmail.com.
And we had a whole bunch of new patrons to announce tonight. And I can't thank you, you people. I can't thank you people enough. And where do people do that?
Oh, that would be patreon.com/registrymatters. And again, we would be happy with just half of your stimulus check.
What about if they have like four children? Are we doing half of the total or just half of the individual?
I think it'd be fair if we got half of the total, because we're trying to work on behalf of the children also.
Oh, definitely. It's because it's all about all the... That's funny, Larry. Well, we record the show usually on Saturday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern. You can join the Discord server and listen live. But if you can't listen live, you can always do so on demand, which is the whole point anyway, to listen on demand. We want to make this available to you at your convenience. If you would do me a favor and subscribe, this is doing yourself a favor to subscribe in your favorite podcast application, whether that's Apple, Google, Stitcher, Pocket Cast, Overcast, whatever. You know, even YouTube, by subscribing, you do two things. One, you make sure that you get every episode the minute we post it. It'll come right to you on your device, so you can have plenty of time for your Tuesday morning commute. If you're commuting yet, I guess is a caveat there. But you're also sending a signal to those apps. Hey, people, listen to this show, and it will help other people discover it as well. At registrymatters.co, you can find show notes and even transcripts. It gets every and it's all in there. It's just like reading, but you're listening. That's all I got, Larry. And I hope you have a fantastic the rest of your weekend. And watch out. Don't get in the sun for too long, because you get nice and toasty and crispy like me. Hey, you want to talk about your little photo real quick? I found an elementary school photo of you online, and what do you think about that photo? You think that's legit?
I think that's a great photo. I didn't know they had photos back then, but apparently I'd forgotten about it.
You can find that over on the YouTube stream that I've been putting together lately. Larry, as always, you are a master of information and explaining, and you are the best, and I super duper appreciate it, and I hope you have a fantastic night.
Thank you. Good night, everybody.
Bye-bye.